Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Social networking, internet style, is just life for hundreds of millions of people these days. And Facebook is leading that charge. As of yesterday, Facebook announced 200 million users can now log in to find out what Annie is reading today, who did what with whom last night, where Joe is working now, and who their exes are dating. But as Facebook grows and evolves, so do the questions about where it's going and where it's taking us. This hour On Point, Facebook at 200 million users and where social networking goes next. You can join the conversation. Is half your life on Facebook? All your life? None of it? Where does Facebook take us? We will talk later in this hour with BJ Fogg, an expert on the psychology of social networking. Joining me first from Moscow, where she's on assignment, is Vanessa Grigoriadis, contributing editor at New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Vanity Fair. Her cover story in New York Magazine this week is, Do You Own Facebook or Does Facebook Own You? Vanessa, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem.
I know it's late there in Moscow, and you're good to be with us, and this is one smart story. You really got your finger on the pulse of what's going on here, not just in the way it's used. We'll talk about that, but you've been out at Facebook World Headquarters talking with founder and CEO and more than that. What do the Facebook founders, leaders, think is going on here? What are they aiming for, Vanessa?
Well, they won't really tell you that. You know, their line is, look, we're just providing a service. It's a utility. It's no different than a telecommunications system. The system of the telegraph once existed. We've got phone systems, and now we have this new utility called Facebook. And we're just allowing people to share information over our, you know, communication system.
Okay.
That's as far as they want to go.
Well, kind of, except you sat down with Mark Zuckerman, 24 years old, founder. And, I mean, he's also got a kind of cosmic vision here of what social networking, Facebook and beyond may be, will be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the larger idea is that it would be an immensely valuable thing if there was some sort of graph, which is called the social graph, of all of the relationships of everybody in the world and how we're all connected to each other. Certainly, you know, this would be a useful thing in that if you think of the way that when HIV/AIDS first erupted, people were worried this was going to decimate the population. And then it turned out that there was really a granularity in the way that people slept with each other. You know, such problems like that and many others could be partially, at least, you know, get on the way to being solved through something like an enormous graph of our relationships. So I think they're very interested in that.
A graph, a kind of X-ray that Facebook would own. Who knows whom, how, and around what issues or interests? Mm-hmm. And can they? Do they look into that? I mean, do they look person by person and sort of check out or do great big sort of meta-analysis of relationships around the world?
No, not specifically. I don't think that that information on Facebook is quite anonymized the way that it is on, say, Google. You mm-hmm. know, this is a robot looking at your information. You know, who really cares? Here, it's more associated with your actual name, your photographs, your kindergarten friends, I mean, your location, what you like to eat. And there's so much information that we are putting on Facebook. And yes, Facebook does own this information. It is a company. And it is a privately held company. Maybe someday soon it'll be a publicly held company. But it is not going to essentially you know, give this back to the world. And I think that that's where, you know, certainly some people in the community of, you know, people who think deeply about the internet are quite concerned because they'll say, well, this is a, you know, a human artifact. I mean, this is something that belongs to all of us. It should be more social than they're allowing it to be.
But they own it. It's theirs. And there's been a lot of hubbub lately about how it's how the interface is put out there on Facebook. We'll talk about that. But essentially, as you write, they've got what they're creating here is a map of every known human relationship in the universe. And that map, Vanessa, is filling in rapidly. I mean, we've gone from 100 million last August, 250 million in January, 200 million now. This thing is just exploding. You remind us that in broad swaths of many American communities, everybody's on Facebook. If you're not on Facebook, you don't. Where are you? You ask. You don't exactly exist.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is the kind of thing where I don't actually believe that they advertise. I mean, it is although they do get some very good press, and there's certainly the peer pressure effect of, well, 200 million people. I mean, come on, get on there yourself. But it definitely is a word of mouth thing, and it gets into a community of people, and then really spreads quickly. I mean, I think I joined about a year and a half ago, and when I did, there were probably about 100 of my friends on it, and now I have over 500 friends, and I very rarely, actively add more people. But in the last couple of months, I would say that it really has tapered off. I don't see a lot of new people that I know on this site, which is part of what my piece is about, because it may be kind of tapping out in at least my circle.
You never know when it's still taking off or when it's topping out, and tastes are kind of fickle here and can move on. You came on your first posting a little tongue-in-cheek. Vanessa is doing cocaine and piercing her nipples. Hello, I'm here. I'm on Facebook. I suppose you got people's attention with that. When you were a big user, or at the height of your using Facebook, how did you use it, Vanessa?
Well, I don't know if I got people's attention. I mean, I think part of the point was that everybody else went, oh, my God, let's just pretend we didn't see that. That's right. So ridiculous.
We won't network that, but yet they will. Of course they will.
She's not following the rules.
Right.
Ignore. I think immediately I was struck, like so many people are, the mundane details that are on Facebook. People are just saying, I drove here today, I went here, I did this and that. And it just was shockingly dull. So I thought, oh, well, this will be funny. But I've realized now that I've been a heavy user of it for a while that it's not very funny. Whenever I see other people do it, I'm like, not funny. But there is, really... sarcasm does not work on Facebook. I mean, irony is not part of Facebook. It is a millennial culture thing, insofar as we understand what that culture may be. I'm from Gen X, and we're, ironic, and we also don't like people really being able to pigeonhole us and say, oh, she's that kind of person. We're very concerned about being posers all the time. And here's something where you're absolutely representing yourself. This is who I am. This is what I'm about.
So you are posing.
But also in the most sanitized way.
So sanitized that it's of necessity a kind of posing? I mean, are you getting a real read on people on Facebook? Is that your sense?
I don't think you are. No. I think that it's everybody's putting their best foot forward, as you would if you were going to a reunion or a large, gathering of people who were colleagues. You, of course, would not start, blabbering about all of your woes, and you would dress up and groom yourself appropriately. And I think the same thing is happening there.
There's this notion that you describe, which also sounds kind of millennial, but the promise of Facebook is a utopian kind of hope for the triumph of fellowship, the rise of a unified consciousness, peace through superconnectivity, rapid bits of information elevating us to Buddha mind, or at least distracting us from whatever problems are at hand. Where does that kind of kumbaya dynamic come from on Facebook?
Well, I mean, I think the idea is that, and I do think there is some truth to it, is that we, if we all come together in this utopian vision, which is always what the web has kind of always been about, we will, understand that we are more alike than we are different. And that will help us create a really tolerant society. It will help, really help political factions that otherwise would not have a voice get a voice. It will make it so that, you know, we can be a unified continent. I mean, a unified, globe, which is, I mean, we live in a global society. And here is a real tangible manifestation of the way we could all come together.
There's the pretty appealing view. You're also reminded us of the sort of Stanley Kubrick dream of villains like, you know, the Facebook gang, nerds in fleece controlling information, calling their cult a family, dressing it up in all that nice stuff. And I guess that's the dystopic vision of what Facebook could be.
Well, it's information control. I mean, these guys are into total information control. They want it, and they want all of it, you know? I mean, personally, I'm not comfortable giving that to anybody. It doesn't matter who they are. I mean, we spoke about third-party developers on the site. A lot of people play games on Facebook.
Putting up applications,
Sure, you can. You know, you play Scrabble, or you send your friend an apple, cute little, you know, a cute doll, or pretend you're a vampire and bite them. And those applications are built by people who don't work at Facebook, and they are allowed, you know, with your consent, to grab a lot of your personal information. And when I expressed a little concern about this, I said, well, you know, these developers, they can be in foreign countries, foreign governments could have this information.
Where the laws are different.
The chief...
Vanessa, hold that quote. We'll come right to it. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking Facebook. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Facebook at 200 million users, confirmed as of yesterday, and where the world's fastest growing online social network is headed next. And I should say, I mean, everybody's diving on. On Point is on. You can become a Facebook fan of On Point. Just follow the link at our website, onpointradio.org. We've been joined from Moscow, where she's on assignment, by Vanessa Grigoriadis. She's written a terrific story, cover story in New York Magazine, headlined, "Do You Own Facebook or Does Facebook Own You?" And Vanessa, you were saying you brought up this sort of evil foreign governments using the information with Facebook itself, and they said?
These foreign developers could give this information to foreign governments. And they said, oh, so the Indian government knows that you like Bon Jovi, and that's a threat to national security?
Ha, ha, ha.
And I laughed, but, you know, I don't think that's very funny, actually. I don't want them even knowing. I'm not a fan of Bon Jovi, first of all, but I don't want them knowing what kind of music I listen to. So I think it's very important to remember that everything that you put on Facebook is essentially public information, despite the fact that the company puts a lot of emphasis on privacy control. You can fiddle with those privacy controls, and you can put an IP blocker on your computer, and you can do all sorts of things like that. But the fact is, we know that 80% of the people who use Facebook do not do that.
They just don't want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
We do know governments are going to be watching. Just down the pike from where you are as we speak, in Moldova, they had a crowd of 10,000 young Moldovans pour out into the streets to protest the communist leadership. They ransacked government buildings. They organized that on Facebook and Twitter. And you can bet that the Moldovan government, if it wasn't already, is going to be paying a lot of attention from now on. Vanessa, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Steve in Columbia, South Carolina. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What do you know?
I just wanted to say that I'm kind of at an age where I kind of missed the Facebook thing, but I caught the MySpace thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, once I got a serious girlfriend, I even got off of MySpace because it was basically something I just used to maintain contact with all the the girls I once knew. And
right.
Yeah.
Facebook, I don't know. Like, it's hard for me to really kind of get on board with it because, I mean, all my friends are on it. And so, you know, I already know what they're up to, but all they do is, like, Facebook stalk, as they call it, and, you know, just check out what everyone's up to all the time, whether, you know, they're eating a sandwich or walking their dogs or whatever mundane activities they're into. But
And how about you, Steve? It sounds like you may be older than the mainstream Facebook crowd. How does that feel, or is it full of people your age now?
Well, I mean, it's funny because there are people, I know a lot of people, like, with you know, people I work with who are a good bit older than me who are on it, and I can't help looking at them just a little strangely, like, you know, this is for college kids and, you know, those who are slightly older than that. But, you know, I do think it's great for, you know, political candidates to spread their message or for a community organization.
Mm-hmm.
But when people are giving up Facebook for Lent, like, that's just a little crazy.
We've read about that. People signing off for Lent as something that they'll give up. Steve, thanks for calling. Vanessa, what do you know about the demographics of Facebook use and how it's changing? As these numbers have exploded, who's in there?
Oh, well, I mean, first of all, it is, you know, that 200 million is actually 70% of those people are out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They're also primarily, I believe, you know, Facebook doesn't give out all of this data, but the fastest growing segment is people who are over 35 years old. So, you know, there is some, even though I believe there are about 95% of college students in the U.S. who are on Facebook now, it's, I don't know, if you went to a college where you actually got a Facebook when you went there, you know, you got a pamphlet that had pictures of everybody who was in your class when right before you went to college, this is their digital Facebook. So they will get, you know, as incoming freshmen, you know, they'll get a link to a group and they'll be able to see their roommate's page and see all the pictures of the people on their floor in their dorm and all of that. So I don't think any of that's going away. But certainly, you know, a lot of people are thinking, all right, are the young people going to really want to stick around here now that their parents are here? And we've seen many cases of employers getting information about young employees behaving inappropriately. So I think that, you know, young people really get that this is not, you know, not a place just for fun at this point.
Let's go to Travis in Sheridan, Iowa. Travis, you're on the air with Vanessa Gregoriadis.
Hi. Thank you. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure at Facebook it used to be just for college use only, like for college students.
It was. It began that way, yeah.
Right. Okay. And now it's just evolved so much, and it doesn't show people truly themselves. It shows rather a highlight of them. And earlier, you said that you couldn't show sarcasm and stuff. I mean, but, like, if you know your friends well enough and you are writing, messaging back, and whatsoever, they'll understand. They'll get your sarcasm if you hang out with them on a daily basis, is what I'm saying.
Right. Hanging out on Facebook as opposed to what it once meant. Travis, thanks for your call. You know, Vanessa, we were reading Farhad Manju in Slate talking about the volume of people who were there, and particularly in, you know, certain bands of the society. And he says it's now so widely trafficked that it's fast becoming a routine aid to social interaction. So what's your sense? If our social interactions are now routinely aided by Facebook, how do you think that changes them, Vanessa?
Well, you know, that's a complicated question. I think, you know, I can speak only for myself. You know, I think that I certainly I'm back in touch with lots of old friends, people I genuinely care about, and it's wonderful. I mean, it's really a miracle to be able to talk to people that you just would not have reached out to before you died. I mean, that's what we're really talking about here, to reclaim all of that.
Of course, college students
time,
who grew up with it never lost that, but an older generation
right,
can find maybe
exactly
anybody there. Mm-hmm.
Sure, yeah. I mean, those people will have to make choices to let go of friends. And there are definitely questions about how their identities will evolve if, you know, they're always findable on this thing. I think everybody, you know, who's over 30 can agree that spending time away from everybody we knew was something that really changed us and matured us as humans. So, I think that it's hard to not see that digital culture has made people uncomfortable in real world situations. I went to a bar the other night in Los Angeles, and you know there were probably 100 people there, and I would say half of them were flicking at their BlackBerries, you know, every 5 or so minutes, and that's just bizarre.
You're together physically there in a bar, but yet that other life is still woven all through.
Right. I mean, mediated life is much more comfortable than unmediated life. It's you get a moment to, you know, it's premeditated, basically. Your identity is premeditated. You can think before you start typing. You can't do that in the real world in the same way. At least I don't.
Vanessa, stand by there in Moscow, if you would. This is great sort of all over the globe conversation. We're joined right now from Sonoma County in California, north of San Francisco, by B.J. Fogg. He's founder and director of the Persuasive Technology Lab at Stanford University, author of Persuasive Technology, Using Computers to Change What We Think and Do. He's got a book coming out, The Psychology of Facebook. B.J. Fogg, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Begin to take us into that. What the psychology of Facebook, like what?
Well, the way I see it, Facebook is all about persuasion. It's all about changing people's behaviors. And there's two sides to that. One is Facebook Incorporated. That's getting people to upload profile pictures, disclose information, and so on. The other side is friends persuading friends to do things, join a group, come to this event, and so on. And so in the book we're putting out, it's an edited volume, we're looking at the kind of the persuasive landscape that Facebook has created.
Life is, I guess, always been about persuasion one way or another, right? You know people, you may persuade them or try to persuade them. Politicians have always tried to persuade advertisers. What's different about this medium?
Well, I think what's different is the reach and the speed. Like one example from Vanessa's article, building the group so quickly. When was that ever possible before to recruit hundreds and thousands of people with very little effort to a cause? So certainly things like that have changed dramatically. It's not like it was before with Facebook and other kinds of tools. You can what I call mass interpersonal persuasion. You can take these interpersonal persuasion dynamics and roll them out on a mass scale. So it's kind of like the combination of mass media and interpersonal, and these things come together on Facebook.
It's not really presented as a persuasion tool. It's presented as a community, as just a great big, you know, interaction. But you think it's really all about persuasion? Why?
Well, I think at the end of the day it is. And certainly as a psychologist, that's my perspective on Facebook and on basically the world. But it's a for-profit company. At the end of the day, the company benefits when you join, when you upload your profile picture, when you connect to other people, when you update your status. All of those things makes Facebook a more valuable company. And of course they want you to do that. The most recent redesign, I think, was done in order to increase time on the site, which is going to make them a more valuable company once people get over the shock of the redesign.
Vanessa, can you describe for us the sort of prairie brush fire revolt against – there's a redesign. A lot of Facebook users were upset about it. What happened?
Well, you know, people were originally upset about some issues over the privacy of information, but mm-hmm. suddenly they did this large redesign, and a lot of those people who, you know, in some ways are people who complain a lot generally about things in life went from one group about privacy of information to say, hey, wait a second, we hate this redesign.
It was kind of to Twitterize Facebook in a way, right? It put these constant
and it was.
Communications
yeah, it,
in the middle
it
of it.
Is. Mm-hmm. And I don't like it that much myself, although, you know, I can see the benefits of it. It really speeds up exchanges. And I think in a way, I think BJ is right that it is a persuasive medium, but I also think you know, stalking and voyeurism is so much a part of the site and what people get out of it. And there's almost like a information swapping. Okay, I'll join your group, but let me look at your profile. Let me try to read into you here. And I think in the redesign, you lost some of that. Personally, I liked that on the site.
Stalking. Let's get a call from South Bend, Indiana. And Josh. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm a professor in anthropology and informatics at Indiana University, South Bend.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to point out to you and your guest the ways in which faculty members at our university and at a number of universities nationwide are also using Facebook as a software as service application to basically provide back channel efforts for sharing information, whether it's for teaching, whether it's for professional research, and also just sharing basically stupid jokes and games too. But
so it's become part of your life as a kind of a big communication network.
It has, and you know, I log on to Facebook now first thing in the day with my email because I use it to disseminate professional information and also to gather it in. And I'm looking at my Facebook page right now. I have a link to a PDF of a meeting poster I gave last week. I have some links to some NSF.
National Science Foundation.
Published through their website.
So it sounds like you feel bigger, expanded, more plugged into more people as a result. Is there a downside for you, Josh?
The downside, I think, in a professional sense, is trying to negotiate the public and private profiling. For my own personal use, I actually created Facebook several years ago just as an example. Basically to mine my students' information to make an example to them about the dangers of putting too much personal information online.
I mean, you put yourself up there to do that, yeah?
And put myself up there to show that as well. And I suddenly started receiving emails about a year ago now from people who are starting, from professional friends and colleagues who are getting onto it. And who found that I was on there, and I suddenly remembered, oh, yes, I do have a Facebook account that you're trying to contact me through.
And now it's taken off and become part of your professional life.
Yeah, it has, and we interact with student groups. We provide information about career opportunities.
Josh, we've got it. Let me put it to Vanessa in Moscow. We just got her for a minute more. Vanessa, there it is, becoming that utility that the guys at Facebook, you know, that's the way they described it to you. Josh seems to accept it that way. You've had a different path of evolution. You've finally ended up irked and more or less walked away. Why, Vanessa?
I think he's right. I think it is used in that way. And I'm not saying that I won't use Facebook in the future because I honestly think that they are going to win this game. And I think I probably will keep my Facebook account open.
Mm.
But I think I'm not that interested in knowing what my friends are doing at every given moment. I find it really distracting. I'd rather focus on reading a good book. I know that sounds like an old fogey kind of thing to say, but there is no question that your level of attention drops when you're using Facebook a lot. I mean, I was checking it like 5 times a day just because I feel lonely. And this is something that makes me feel good. But, you know, we shouldn't always just become addicted to things that make us feel good. Use it as a utility. Get the information you need from it and get off of it.
BJ Fogg, stand by. We want to learn more about the psychology and how you're looking at that. Vanessa Gregoriadis had the cover story in New York Magazine. Do you own Facebook or does Facebook own you? Was good enough to join us from Moscow, no less. Vanessa, you're great. We hope you'll come again. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tom.
Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Facebook at 200 million users and where the world's fastest growing online social network is headed. Next, BJ Fogg is with us from Sonoma County in California, author of Persuasive Technology and forthcoming, The Psychology of Facebook. He's looked at it inside out, upside down, and backwards. B.J. Fogg, you said one big element of persuasion here, and that's your focus, is what the company wants to persuade its users of. And what is that exactly? What's their goal, mission?
Well, first and foremost is to get you to join Facebook and connect to friends on the service. And then in addition to that, to disclose information about yourself, to use the service to share, and so on. And I think they've been incredibly successful in that regard. It's hard to think of any company who's been more successful. And that's why I think it's the number one persuasive technology of all time. It's changed more people's behaviors faster and more significantly than any other technology system I can think of.
We know it's already seen as very valuable, but if they persuade us to get on there and then to begin sharing all kinds of information, what's in it for Facebook, Inc.?
Well, like Vanessa was talking about, this social graph, this map of who's connected to whom and how they're relating to each other. When you think about it, that's a unique asset. Nobody else has that mapped out in such detail with true identities and so on. So what they're building is something that has never come together before. The way they monetize it, that's an open question that I'm not necessarily an expert on. But the value of creating that thing, that social graph, is really, really curious. Certainly, there's got to be a lot of trust in Facebook as a company. What are they going to do with that information and so on? But it's really in their best interest to do the right thing, because if they don't, at the end of the day, I agree with Vanessa, Facebook will win this game. And I don't think anybody can beat them. The only thing that can happen is Facebook will beat themselves or do something that users really hate, and there'll be a huge revolt. So they're not going to do that. I think Facebook, they've shown themselves to be good citizens, and I think they'll continue to be so, and they'll be good guardians of the data.
Though it's happened before. People have moved off. MySpace was the hot thing, and it's really in the backseat now to Facebook.
Yeah, I think Facebook is different. My mom would have never considered to be on MySpace, for example. I wouldn't have taught a class on MySpace. I wouldn't run a class using MySpace as a platform. But all those things are happening on Facebook now.
Let's go to Gabrielle in Burlington, Vermont. Gabrielle, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you know?
I joined Facebook from a few years ago. I was introduced to it by a group of 17-year-olds that I worked with.
Yep.
I'm 30 years old now, and I feel like I'm becoming increasingly obsessed with it. And I'm very disappointed in myself for spending so much time looking at what other people are doing, and most of the time people that I couldn't care anything about. My mother just joined Facebook, and I find it now easy to keep in touch with her because she lives far away from me, the rest of my family as well, classmates that I used to know. But half the time I'm spending my time looking at coworkers and people that I see every day and finding out things about their lives that I really just don't want to know about. I mean, where do we draw the line about knowing things about people that we just don't need to know?
Hang on with us, Gabrielle. B.J. Fogg, Dr. Fogg, what do you make of this? She's obsessed with it and a little, disgusted with herself about that, but can't help it.
Well, the interest in using Facebook isn't a huge surprise, By nature, we're social creatures, human beings. We're wired to live in packs and have social awareness and try to understand what our social landscape looks like and what's going on there. And Facebook is really the most convenient way of understanding our social landscape. It helps us stay connected to friends. It helps us learn about new people. It helps us build relationships. And it helps us express who we are in a fairly convenient and, like Vanessa said, a sanitized kind of way.
But Gabrielle doesn't even know a bunch of these people, and still she's obsessively, she says, following them, and she almost wishes she weren't. Psychologically, that's interesting.
There are many ways to use Facebook, and certainly that's a pattern that some people use it for. I think there are ways to use it to promote your career or other kinds of life skills, leadership skills, strengthening relationships, learning skills, and so on. And I think there's a lot of talk about Facebook and privacy and Facebook addiction, but there's really a positive side of using the kinds of things that are going on Facebook now will be the kinds of things we do the rest of our lives, whether Facebook ends up winning the game or not. The genie's out of the bottle. We're not going to go back. We're going to be using these kind of social networking sites, these simple ways to connect and stay updated on people. And I think what we have to look forward to is how these kinds of things can help us develop professional skills. In my own case, I get feedback on my research and my ideas. I run classes. So it's not just social. It's not just like going to a cocktail party and hanging out. There's, I think, useful and practical and really great things we can be doing from sort of a career or personal development standpoint.
Gabrielle, what do you say? On balance, are you glad you're on there or are you trying to wean yourself?
I'm trying to wean myself off of it. I find that I spend too much time thinking about other people when I should be doing other constructive things. It's completely voyeuristic for me at this point, and I think that it's something that I need to learn to curb. So I think that the balance issue is something that needs to be learned, and possibly learning, you know, networking part would be a good idea, but maybe just keeping in touch with my family at this point is what I should be focusing on. And going and picking up a book in my spare time would be a little more productive, I think.
But it's interesting. Your story reminds us what potent stuff this is, how compelling. Thanks for calling. Tim in Boston, you're on the air, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
There are so many interesting points I was just thinking of making, but the one I want to make the most is how Facebook has become much more of a social support network for me lately.
Why lately, Tim?
Well, as of last Tuesday, I was laid off from my job.
Okay.
And I've been laid off before, but this time is slightly different. I don't have that feeling of isolation and disconnectedness that I had before, because within the hour of being laid off, I had used the Facebook app on my BlackBerry.
Yeah.
And I posted a status update to say, cleaning out my desk, was just laid off. And within the hour, I had so many supportive messages from friends, including links to job hunting sites from my other friends who are also unemployed. So we're using it as another tool in our toolbox for job hunting, as well as emotional support.
Those both sound very useful. How old are you, Tim?
45.
And so even in your sort of peer group, you had lots of people who were on, plugged in, and responding to you just that fast.
Yes. Within the last year, I've reconnected with so many people. As Vanessa said earlier, some of these people I thought I was never going to be in touch with again. I feared I'd die without ever hearing from them. And people from my roommate in freshman year of college is on there. People from my first job are on there. People from the job I love most are on there.
That's great. Tim, we hope it helps you out and gets you right back in the working saddle, supports you along the way. BJ Fogg, what do you hear in this story?
Well, I think, again, there's many ways to use Facebook, and this is one way, reaching out for help and getting support and so on. But I think underlying that, there's a larger trend going on here. When you're connected to hundreds of people, you know, 300, 500, 700, whatever it might be, certainly the the characteristic of your relationships change. It used to be that you would have a core group of people you were very close to. You had these strong ties and some weak ties. Now with Facebook and the way that it's designed, and I've criticized Facebook for this, and I've talked to them about it, and it doesn't look like they will be changing dramatically soon. Now the relationships tend to be on an even footing. It is harder to, if I have 700 friends on Facebook, how do I nurture those relationships that matter most? And so I think what's going on, and it's an extension of email and other kinds of technology, is our relationship landscape is flattening.
And so it's harder to make distinctions between inner circle and Outer Mongolia?
Yeah, I think so. And it may not be distinctions, but, you know, if I've got 700 relationships to manage, what happens to those 3 to 5 relationships that really matter to me? Certainly, they're not going to be as rich. I won't have as much time to develop those relationships.
Interesting. Bigger, more present all the time, but flatter and maybe not as intimate. Let's go to Detroit and Brad. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I wanted to illustrate what I see in the difference between MySpace and Facebook. And namely, in MySpace, I enjoy the ability to put a personal aesthetics on the site and sort of personalize it a little more fully. I'm an artist by trade. I tattoo, and I like to be able to post a lot of my own personal aesthetics.
Yeah.
And that's something I find on Facebook that I don't see. And just one other point I'd like to make, and that's just sort of the, I guess, evolutionary aspect of the communication available with this modern technology, sort of moving toward what I see as an omnipresence among humanity, a step towards a means towards lesser or less symbolic means of communication. And I feel that Facebook sort of creates a larger dynamic whereby people can communicate, and I feel that on a larger scale it's a move towards a sort of shared consciousness without an external form of communication.
Yeah, that world mind. But let me ask you, Brett, MySpace may be right up front. You can have more graphics, but on Facebook you can put up all the photos in the world. That's not good enough for you, Mr. Tattoo Man?
I like to pull it up. I like to, you know, the second I pull up my profile and just see that, you know, I have a big background with some of my art, and I have music that comes on right away. And, you know, if I could learn some of the software languages and be able to make my own website, that'd be great. But, you know, I'm not that technologically inclined, so MySpace is sort of just that knob that I can maintain with some ease.
Brad in Detroit, we love it, and thank you very much for calling. Our time begins to tick down. BJ Fogg, what about it, graphically, the difference between MySpace and Facebook, and Facebook really moving a bit more away from that, you know, first sort of powerful graphic punch when you first come to people's pages? What's going on with that? And what do you think about the world mind kind of talk that Brad reminds us of?
Yes, certainly MySpace gives you more options to express yourself visually. And I think Facebook smartly has differentiated itself from that. I think a few years ago, 2 years ago, the MySpace Facebook thing was all tangled together and the discussions around online predators and so on. And I think Facebook has been able to distinguish itself as being perhaps the more credible, trusted social network, in part because your identities there on Facebook are mostly real identities. People are who they say they are. And even within the Facebook construct, you can express who you are by sharing photos, videos, links, notes. Used to be you could put applications on your profile page. Now they're kind of hidden behind a tab. But, you know, two or three redesigns ago, you could put these third-party apps on your profile page and you had more expression that way. Facebook has become, you know, in the redesign, they have streamlined things. But one of the things I think that hasn't been talked about enough are the friend lists that they've brought up to the top page. And now, instead of having this mysterious algorithm that, you know, Facebook decides what ends up in my stream or my news
feed. Stream of comments, yeah.
Yeah. That used to be mysterious, and what showed up depended on Facebook and not on me. Now I'm allowed to filter that. So I have a family group. I click on that. I can see what's a friends list. I mean, I can see what my family's doing. I've got a student's one. I've got one for industry colleagues and so on. And so it actually gives me more control as a user to see what I want to see in that newsfeed or that stream.
We'll go to World Mind. Let's hear from some of those folks in that mind. Harlan, Iowa, Josh, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. What do you know?
All right. I just wanted to share a little story. This is coming from a friend of mine. I'm a freshman in college right now. Last mm-hmm. year, I was a senior in high school.
Yep.
And a friend of mine got dumped by his girlfriend. And he decided, you know, this girl was everything to him. You know, she's means all kinds of stuff to him, apparently.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And would go on her Facebook page and look at photos of her and look at her friends and talk to them and find out what she's up to and look at her events and see what party she was going to be at so he could accidentally run into her and all kinds of stuff like that.
So is that weird for her, weird for him? What do you think, Josh?
Oh, certainly weird for me, but probably weird for her, and I think just his actions were a little unusual. I mean, in the whole context of things, I suppose, you know, high school romance, it's pretty tame, but if it's able to do that with high school, suppose you have, you know, a serious, you know, sort of predator who is able to, you know, follow around people like that. What do you think of that?
Yeah, Josh, BJ Fogg, this word stalker has come up repeatedly in the conversation. It's sometimes just used sort of in jest, but here it's, you know, spurned lover in the grip of that. Mm-hmm. And maybe more, Josh wonders. What do you say?
Well, I think any powerful technology can be used for good purposes or bad purposes. And certainly there's been plenty of stories in the media about stalking and I think, the less desirable side. But, Tom, I kind of want to turn it back to your earlier, the positive side about World Mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think the overall trend here is positive, definitely positive. And in my Stanford lab, we think Facebook and things like Facebook are an important step forward toward world peace. And we mean that really seriously. If we ever achieve world peace.
Why does it lead in that direction?
Well, let me give a pretty simple example. Even 10 years ago, if you asked a high school student to get in touch with somebody from Turkey and comment on what they thought of Barack Obama, that would have been a really, really hard task.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to do that today and ask a high school student, find somebody from Turkey and ask them what they think about Barack Obama, they could get that done. So the world certainly is a smaller place. We're more connected. We're making friends across country boundaries, but also across generational lines. And I think Facebook is bringing people, potentially bringing people together in ways that can be very positive, where we can work together. And it's not Facebook. It's the whole range of Web 2.0 technologies and tools and services. I think it's very exciting. There's never been a more exciting time on the internet or with technology than now. And I'm really hopeful we can use these tools to do good things in the world on a global scale.
We just got 20 seconds. It'll change the interactions. Will it change the individuals within that network? Does it make us different one by one as we connect up this way?
Yeah, I think so. And then as we aggregate all the individuals, we will change the culture. I think we will change the face of the world through these technologies.
Wow. Well, that's as big as it gets. Change the culture, change the individuals, change the world. BJ Fogg's forthcoming book is The Psychology of Facebook. He's founder and director of the Persuasive Technology Lab at Stanford University. BJ Fogg, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us at Twitter at On Point Radio and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. It's all out there everywhere these days. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.